This is tape recording number 5108C14, HEV5. A tape recorded lecture given by L. Ron Hubbard on the 14th of August, 1951. The title of this lecture is Human Evaluation. It is 30 minutes and 13 seconds long. Copyright C, 1951-1973 by L. Ron Hubbard. All world performance rights reserved. This recording has been re-recorded by the Flag Audio Unit of the Flagship Apollo of the Sea Organization. In this lecture, Ron explains behavior and punishment and discusses evolution on Theta and GE lines. And now, here is L. Ron Hubbard.
One magnetic field. And they quickly tore up that set of data, tore up that experiment, and performed it again. And they found the same answer. So they tore it up and they performed it again and they found the same answer and they chucked in the sponge and said, obviously it can't be so, so we haven't observed it. But that's poor science. So they wrote it up anyway to explain why they hadn't observed it. But actual truth of the matter is that I conducted a few experiments along this line and I found out that there is not a multipoint field. There is no multipoint field around a body of simple cells. There's no unit point field. There's nothing but a multipoint field. There's a point for every cell. That's very interesting. Evidently, this, by the way, is easy to test. And there's a lot of experimentation got to go on in this field. But it means simply that there's an overall sort of a life form. You might say there's a big field. And how it's pinned to the organism, why it's there, what it is, this is for somebody else to answer. The point is, at the moment of actual organism death, full death, so on, this field disappears. And you fall back on this field. A few minutes later, I think 8 minutes later, the red blood cells die. About 10 minutes later, another blood cell dies, another type of blood cell, and so on, down to fingernails, which last about a year and a half. The body dies minutes, and then some more of it dies in an hour, and some more of it dies in a week, and some more of it dies in 2 months. This is the cellular life, which persists after the organism is, quote, unquote, dead. Now, that's very interesting. We've got all these varying forms of death. I indebted to that data to the medical examiner of the city of New York, who has the very, very proud reputation of having cut up more corpses than any other man alive. Now, when it comes to the individuality of an organism, one can postulate some very interesting things. He can postulate several kinds of evolution. Here's one kind of evolution that starts in with a monocell and goes up here to some very, very complex organism like a biologist. Now, that's one chain of evolution. That would just say the complexity and plan of the organism itself. Now, it's a funny thing, but for every organism which has existed all the way along this track, matter and energy of the physical universe have evolved. They've changed. They have been changed by life. Today, chemists find there are innumerable compounds which can be manufactured only by life. But the cells manufacture these things. They are actually changing matter and energy in space and time. So you have the cells making new compounds, and it leaves an actual physical universe evolution change. To that degree, these cells take on chemicals, put off other chemicals in other forms. They pick up things, combine new elements, throw them away, discard them. Man builds a railroad and abandons it. He's changing matter and energy in space and time. It's the evolution of the physical universe. So you have over here, you have another universe, a physical universe evolution chain. That evolution is taking place too. And you have another one over here, which is the unit organism evolution chain. Now, we've been calling in Dianetics this life energy, just to give it a symbol so it won't get mixed up with anything else. We call it theta. And there's a theta evolution change of the chain of some sort. I'm not quite sure what it is, but it seems to exist there. as organisms go on and get more complex, evidently the theta body, you might say, becomes more complex. Life seems to have been formed out of the whole stuff of life into individualities, and those individualities seem to travel along. As soon as you get up to this level, you find that this data begins to be supported by actual evidence. You look at it, you sense, measure, and experience this evidence. You begin to see that maybe you're dealing with a system which is perhaps a little closer to workable than past systems. We're not having to worry now about whether or not this is the human soul, or what is the behavior of the human soul, or what is the fate of it. Nothing like that. That's somebody else can worry about that. We just know there's an energy there. We can prove there's an energy there. That energy, life, in its individualized forms of the organism, stays in pretty good alignment with the whole purpose of life, except as the organism begins to be pounded around by the physical universe. And then you get aberration. You get inefficiency. You get other things. An organism is life plus the physical universe, energy and matter. You see, the organism is this life force plus the physical universe form, and you get an organism. Now, this organism is a mobilized unit which has the purpose of conquest and which goes on and attacks various projects in the physical universe to make more organisms, to fit the environment better so that life can conquer it, and so on and so on and so on. And in the process, you have practically every life form outliving its usefulness. Practically every one of them. I was telling you yesterday, last night, about the horrors if there was no death. Life comes in, call this conception, grows, comes up here to peak, falls on off, goes over here to death. Here's entrance for theta, here's exit for theta. The organism develops. The cadaver, the purely physical universe part of the individual, just drops off, and that's that. But in comes the theta, goes through this cycle, growth, decay, and out it goes. A whole species will go through this, or just one man will. Now, death is terrifically valuable, because without death, you'd never get a change of organism form. If you didn't scrap tanks, you'd still be fighting with World War I tanks, God forbid. If tanks lasted forever. So there's a certain destructibility which is desirable in any organism. The theta part, or the life energy part of the thing, evidently in every cycle picks up more knowledge about the physical universe. Now that isn't very esoteric, it just means that we know more about the science of physics than Isaac Newton's generation did. Knowledge coming along in the whole culture. And a culture, by the way, goes on this cycle too. It's new. It develops a tremendous body of information. It gets up here to the peak, then it coasts off and slides on down to America 1952. And the whole culture will go on this cycle, or single organism, or the species, any one of these things. Now, the point we're trying to make is that the theta does an evolution. It gets to know more and more and more about the physical universe's contact. We have today atomic physics. That's a lot more than we knew 10 years ago, 15 years ago. It is refining. But how does it get this knowledge? Well, here's a piece of physical universe, and here's an organism, and the organism collides with the physical universe. You get an interpolated area there. The organism pulls back and it says, well, well, I'm not supposed to run into fence posts. It's learned something. It's learned that when walking toward a fence post, one takes a step sideways in order to go around the fence post. And then one doesn't hit the fence post and one doesn't get headed. Very simple and elementary, but that's the basic lesson. And that lesson stays in the organism represented by stored pain. Now, because organisms were pretty stupid before man came along, and because man is not doing too badly right now, if you want to be charitable, man is a thinking entity. But life before man wasn't. A dog is a thinking entity to a very slight degree. He has a prefrontal lobe. Prefrontal lobe is evidently the site of the consciousness, the site of awareness, the site of the computation. And the dog has one about the size of a pea. An elephant has a pretty big one. Great big one, about a fifth the size of a man, something like that. And here's man with this tremendous great big frontal lobe. There's been a big jump there in evolution. Either we skipped a lot of them on the way or something happened there. But man got up to a point where he developed a brand new method in evolution. The dog runs along and he's tearing along as a puppy and he runs into the fence post. He steps sideways, goes around the fence post. The next time he starts to run into the fence post, he'll just start to get near the fence post. He'll start to get pain at the last place he hit. It won't even come into his consciousness, but it'll just slightly agitate, and he'll dive sideways and go around the fence post. You take a dog, you're training him to do something. You do so-and-so with him, and if you keep working with him, interrupting the line between his thinking process and his muscles, if you keep working his muscles, instead of letting his thinking process work his muscles, you'll get him into any kind of a conditioning you want. You can turn a dog into a rabbit. Just that way. A well-trained dog is actually a rabbit, whereby the master has interrupted the dog's thinking process, and the master's thinking process has been substituted for it. You don't even have to do it with much punishment, but you've got to do it with physical energy, so that when you say, sit, the dog doesn't say, let's see, sit. That's a three-letter English word, and the action means to squat down on my haunches because I have watched other dogs do it. No, he doesn't do that. His muscle response is, when you say sit, he goes, and the reason he does that is because you have told him lots of times, sit, and you've made him sit. 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 And he finally gets to the point where you don't have to touch him anymore. You say sit, and he feels your hands on him, pushing him down. He gets the sensation of being pushed down when you say sit. So, to avoid the pain, he sits down. And he's just conditioned into it. That's what you'd call conditioning. Now, a man has another gimmick, very interesting one, called mimicry. A man learns by watching another man. A man doesn't have to be punished into it. And as a matter of fact, if he is punished into it and made into this rabbit proposition with a dog, a man is very aberrant, because a man was built, evidently, to learn by mimicry, not by punishment. His prefrontal lobes got up to the point where he could think things out, so that he could actually figure out the first time he ever tapped his forehead on anything, he walks up to something, a fence post, and it goes boom. Only he didn't even hit himself very hard. He looks at it and he says, you know, it's a funny thing, but every time I run into hard objects, I hurt. Now that means that I should avoid all hard objects in the future. So he does. He can extrapolate such tremendous distances. He can, furthermore, a dog will stand on the curb and watch another dog be run over and will not learn the data that a dog gets run over if he runs in the road. He could go out in the road then. He might get run over too. But a man can watch somebody walk out into the road and be hit and then suddenly say, no jaywalking for me. Completely aside from tickets, it's not healthy. There's the difference of learning process. A man's learning process is tremendously extended. And as such, man does not any longer have the need of this stored pain. Psychologists working with and observing dogs and watching dogs go on stimulus response on pain erroneously conceived the fact that a man was trained only by pain. A man is aberrated only by pain, because a man will fight till the last dog is vivisected to retain control of himself in his environment. And he'll really fight to try to accomplish that. The urge towards self-determinism is so strong in a man that it takes 2 or 3 years in the army to break it down. It's really rough. You have to do the most fantastic things to a human being to let him give up some of his self-determinism. Of course, you get a society that's very constricted, that's very aberrated, that believes that an individual has to be beaten and pounded and punished into being a social animal, that has developed a whole field of learning which depends wholly upon punishment drive. Men have to be punished in order to make them good. And then never observe the fact that the more you punish the man, the worse he got. I mean, they've had 50,000 years to observe this fact, never observed it. You know, next time I see a psychiatrist, I'm going to ask him to let me in on his next cure of one of his patients so I can take a look at the prefrontal lobe and find out if it could possibly develop much further, because it's got to develop a little bit further, because there's some stupidities along the line which really don't entitle man yet to the title of sentient thinking being, because some of these things are very thoughtless. What's the best thing to do with a criminal? Well, put him in jail. Well, that's recent. What was the best thing to do with a criminal a century ago? Whipping, corporal punishment. And then never observe that after you whipped a criminal, he became more criminal. In 1780, there was a tremendous upsurge of crime in England. It followed immediately on the heels of the introduction of corporal punishment to a degree which had never before been accomplished in England. A man would go out on the street, economics were bad. And a man would go out on the street and he'd pick up a slice of bread or something like that off a counter and run with it. Well, he'd hang. A fella would go out and on the high road and stop a traveler and do a little more than pass the time of day, and he would be hung, drawn, and quartered. That was kind of rubbing it in. And they executed people. They put them in stocks. They beat them with whips. They were unable to keep their navy in good order or get volunteers for the navy, so they introduced and used lavishly the cat of nine tails until a failure of a seaman to properly use the right word to an officer, imagine that, would cause him to be lashed to a grating and given 12 with the cat, which would, of course, put him in bed for days, because 12 with the cat would lay open the flesh and show his spine to the air. And that was the period of the greatest amount of crime in England. And the more they punished, the worse it got. And they kept right on punishing. We do that in America today. You get a little kid, he's rather rebellious. Somehow or other, nobody quite notices the point where this kid starts to turn bad. And the kid grows up and he starts to tear off wallpaper, and he goes around and he pulls all of mama's dresses down off the coat hooks and cuts them up with a pair of scissors. And every time he does one of these tricks, he gets punished. So the next time he operates on it, he makes sure he gets only the best dresses, and he pulls those down and he cuts them up only with the sharpest scissors. And if you work on this kid enough, you can get him up to the point where he will commit these crimes deviously enough so that he can't be detected, but that the crimes are 8 or 9 times as bad. He's really winning then. Man almost refuses to be driven out of his heritage or his mission, his overall mission of given him by life to conquer the physical universe. He can be driven down away from it. He can be disassociated from it to some degree, and he can be badly malconcentrated on his subject. But to drive him completely off of it is to drive him insane. That's actually the only thing wrong, you would say, with the insane. They have lost any ability they might have had to control their environment, to conquer the physical universe. If you remember that, in treating a psychotic, by the way, you can really start laying stuff out. You would say immediately, well, here we've got this fellow, let's see, standard psychiatric treatment. We've got him in cuffs, we've got him in restraints, we've got him in a small cell, and everybody comes in and they slap him. Is there anything wrong with this in the treatment of psychosis? You say, well, in view of the fact that it was too much restraint in the first place that drove him psychotic, I wonder what would happen if we took the cuffs off. They find that out, by the way. The governor of Minnesota or Wisconsin or someplace up there had issued an order one day And he had to say it, I think, about five times and threaten about and fire about 12 guys before he finally got him into effect. But in the state institution, he had all restraints removed. All restraints, all cuffs and everything. And everybody that had anything to do with psychotic stuff at that time said, if you do this, that's going to finish everything. I mean, they'd just go around and they'd murder all the keepers. And they'd had a lot of bad incidents in this institution. They took off all the restraints. They took off all these muffs. And they opened a lot of cell doors that hadn't been opened before. And the turbulence in the asylum went right down. It got to be calm. And once in a while, they could even discharge a patient as well, which they hadn't been able to do before. Removing restraints. It's restraint, in other words. It's telling the person that he has no right to conquer the physical universe. It's denying him part of the mission of life, denying him part in a group's missions in conquering the physical universe that drives him down, disassociates him from his fellows, and that finally will put him in an aberrated state. You put him into too much of an aberrated state, about that, life will then start removing him. He becomes destructive. He goes on down, goes out the bottom. This is the cycle on which life might be said to be engaged. He comes up here till he's effective. Then he can no longer affect the physical universe around him, on out. But this can happen at any point in the career. The age of the organism should not be postulated on how many years this organism's got to go, because that will only tell you what will be his usual, his physical decay if no other factors enter. You take into consideration this fact of, at that time when he ceases to be able to adequately effect change or conquest of the physical universe around him, he will then decline rapidly and die. If you take that, you can see a child lose it at the age of 9. You know you'll probably be, unless something strange happens, some terrific miracle happens, he'll be dead by the time he's 12. It doesn't matter that he's now only 9. By accident, by illness, by any one of 1,000 factors in a complex society, he will accomplish demise. That's a very funny thing, but you can go out and you can watch this. They lose the belief in the ability to affect the physical universe, and they're asked to hand in their checks right there. By suicide, by... the fellow doesn't have any appetite all of a sudden. He doesn't like to eat. He sits around. He imagines a bug comes along, that this bug is going, bacteria is very lethal. Somebody says it isn't, but he insists that it is, and he'll up and die from it. It's really wonderful. If you want some data on this, take the obituary column of the paper. You know, there's nothing like looking at the real universe. It's all very well to go and find a book, but I never saw a book yet that wasn't just a small part of the physical universe. It's a rectangular, it's a rectahedron with a lot of blackened symbols on it. But that's the only part of the physical universe it is. Maybe the table sitting alongside of it, if you looked at it squarely, would tell you more about the physical universe than all the books there are stacked on it. Go and get an obituary column. Look in the obituary column. And if you really want to go about and do some research, you have to do strange things like this. You don't want to go and find out what somebody has written happens. You don't want to go find that out because he might not have observed it correctly. Let's find out firsthand. And an organism passed out there. call up the widow. So sorry to hear that John was dead. Oh, did you know him? Yes. I haven't seen him for a number of years. What happened to him? Well, it was after his business failure. I always told him it would be his business failure that would be his downfall. I told him he ought to sold that business. How long ago was this? Well, it was about 2 years ago. Well, what happened? Well, didn't you hear about it? His partner cheated him and ran away with all the money. He couldn't start up another business, he said. I told him he could start up another business, but he said he wouldn't be able to. He said he guessed that was too much, and I guess it was the fact that he was a friend of the fellow. But anyway, a couple of years ago, and he never really was right since. Maybe it's better off that he was dead. Call up Bill and Susie and Agnes and the other names in the old bit column. Unless they've been riding with an accident prone in an automobile that swerved sideways and ran into another automobile driven by another accident prone and got themselves involved as secondary effect on a couple of life rejections, you'll find the same story. Here was a peak physical universe. Conquest can now not be affected any longer. And maybe it sometimes takes as long as 3 years. But if anybody's knocking together life insurance statistics and he doesn't pay attention to this one, his statistics won't be very correct. All due respect to National Casualty. Got some friends over at National Casualty. I was over there inspecting a few things. I was astonished to find out a couple of things that some of the most dangerous professions in the world, they were smiling. They're practically non-insurable, they said. And they were smiling about it because the funny part of it was is the longevity of people engaged in those professions was fantastic. But they were awfully dangerous. There were lots of accidents in those things. The liability toward death was tremendous. But you know what they were talking about? They were talking about deep sea divers and test pilots. Well, every once in a while, there was a fellow by the name of Hubbard, another Hubbard. He was Boeing's test pilot up in Seattle, and he became an innocent bystander to one of these accident-prone affairs. An Army pilot on the first B-17 that was sold to the Army was checked over by Hubbard. Hubbard was standing in the aisle behind him. And he said, now you got her all checked out. Now you've got that whole list checked, haven't you? He was turning the plane over to the Army. He'd been flying it successfully for a long time. And the Army boy said, oh, yes, we got it all checked out. And they taxied down the runway and they took off at the end of the runway, only they didn't take off. They had checked out everything but the control lock. And that plane had hurtled down the runway at umpteen God knows how many miles an hour, and its controls were still locked. And that was the first B-17 that was to be delivered to the Army. And he lingered for about 3 days and died. But there he was a secondary process. He was a secondary cause. The point is, deep sea divers, test pilots, these people, look at the tremendous amount of physical universe these boys are up against. Well, I don't think anything nowadays. A test pilot, I suppose most of these test pilots have kicked around 600 miles an hour in level flight. So I look at the physical universe he's got his hands on. The mortality rate is not very high amongst test pilots. It sure sounds awful good, and it reads good, and all that sort of thing. But, gosh, this fellow's really conquering missed. And you talk to these boys, their elan is way up. But unfortunately, these guys live in the vicinity of lots of boys that are on the other side of a life rejection. They have to trust. It's a wonderful thing how their personality, you might say their own persistence in life, will repair carburetors, put together broken crankshafts 10,000 feet in the air. Planes come in that never should come in. Things happen that never, by any possible chance, should happen. And yet these boys will come out of it alive. And then some morning, some mechanic will have a fight with his wife, come out, fix the motor, fix something, fix it all up. Nice death trap. He walks off, test pilot gets in with it, whoosh, boom. Of course, the mechanic does it to the test pilot because he's the guy that's doing something dangerous, so he can really affect some death there. These people then not only get over the top of the hump here and become life rejects, more or less slowly, some of them rapidly, but they know become life reject potentials or rejected organisms from life, but they will seem to have a mission of looking around them and finding out how many other organisms they can reject from life and how much other havoc that they can bring and destroy. Very interesting thing to observe. The contagion of this sort of thing, as though a person who goes over the hump then has a mission of taking four more out with him. That's a very, very crude example. I'm not trying to give that to you as any really basic scientific lore. But I've watched enough of these dangerous professions. I wrote a series of stories about them one time just to get up close to them. And those boys really fascinated me. what they can live through. And inevitably, it will be somebody who has nothing to do with them, really, who really shouldn't be around them, that will cause their death. They are in a position where death can be caused. I remember walking up to the top of a very high skyscraper to interview a steeplejack. And I looked over the edge of the window, and he was out there. He was repairing a flagpole and so forth. I was way back from the window, and, "How do you like your job?" See? Right? Wind blowing out there, and I couldn't hear him, you know. All right, get a little closer. And he got impatient about this thing. Finally, he says, "Come on out!"